Consumer protection is being ironed out.
So, what will it look like?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, July 29th. The Fed Chairman and Treasury Secretary are meeting today with other regulators over how to build a new consumer watchdog.
Also, there's a hearing in Boise, Idaho today to sort out the hundreds of lawsuits in the BP Gulf of Mexico oil spill. And Goldman Sachs emails are now rated PG. But first,
the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner are meeting today to talk about how to build a new consumer watchdog and what it's going to take to get it going. Reporter Janet Babin is with us live to talk about what we know so far. Good morning, Janet.
Hey, Steve.
Remind us what this new agency is supposed to do.
So this is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and it's going to regulate everything from credit cards to mortgages. This agency was created as part of that sweeping federal overhaul legislation signed last week by the president, and this was one of many parts of the law that banks had fought.
All right, so we have the Fed Chair Bernanke and Secretary Geithner and the regulators going to address the bankers' concerns today.
Well, this is really about the work of getting it up and running. The future battle is going to be over how far this bureau can go in limiting what financial products are allowed on the market. Greg McBride's an analyst at the personal finance website, Bankrate.com, and he says this new bureau is going to have to show a little temperance.
It's going to have to be very deliberately done so that they're representing the interests of the average consumer while not stifling the innovation in the marketplace that's so critical to recovery.
All right, so we've talked about what the agency's going to do. Any news today about what it's going to look like, Janet?
Well, staffing is still happening. The Washington Post reports that employees from several federal agencies, including Treasury, could be assigned to work at this new bureau. And we still don't know, Steve, who's going to head the bureau up. President Obama is reviewing several candidates, including Elizabeth Warren.
Janet Babin reporting live for us. Janet, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
We're seeing a healthcare shift happening in this country, one reported on by the Wall Street Journal today. It says insured Americans are using fewer medical services of all sorts. Patient visits to doctors' offices, hospitals, and labs are down in the last 3 months from a year ago. And there are concerns about whether that has something to do with the fact that people are paying bigger chunks of covered medical costs. Jonathan Cohn is senior editor of The New Republic, where he also has a blog. He wrote the book Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis. Jonathan is with us live from Eastham, Massachusetts. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for being with us. We're seeing fewer people undergoing medical services. Why?
Well, really, two things are happening at the same time. The first is that we're in a recession. People are naturally more cautious about spending money. In addition to that, healthcare is still getting more expensive, and in particular, people are seeing their out-of-pocket expenses for individual procedures go up. So you put those two together, and you go to the doctor's office, doctor says, we recommend you get this treatment, you're going to think a couple seconds more, you're going to think a little harder, do I really need this, do I really want this, it's going to cost me more money.
Is that bottom-line stuff from health insurance companies, you know, we're going to charge more for these procedures for the patients?
Well, it is. I mean, obviously, health insurance companies are trying to make a profit, part of that is, you know, they have to figure out how much money they can transfer on to pass over to the individual beneficiaries. It's the insurance companies and it's the employers. But also, it's individuals buying insurance who may say, well, gee, rather than pay a higher insurance premium, I'd rather have a lower premium and more out-of-pocket costs.
We hear, Jonathan, about people foregoing elective stuff, you know, plastic surgeries and the like, but what about the procedures that really need to be done?
Well, that's always the danger. People are cutting back on their health care. Sometimes they're going to cut back on things they don't need, and sometimes they're going to cut back on things they do need. Obviously, if people are foregoing elective procedures, particularly or procedures maybe they didn't need to put, you know, tests that weren't necessary, well, that's probably a good thing. On the other hand, if they're skipping their heart medication or they're not getting a diabetes checkup, well, that's a bad thing. And so it's a mixed bag, and we don't know yet how much of each is going on.
And what about health insurance? Very quickly, about 10 seconds. What about health insurance reform? What's going to do about this?
Well, the goal of reform is to make sure people do, when they're cutting back on care, that they can pay for what they need and the good stuff, and to the extent they're cutting back, that they're cutting back only on the unnecessary stuff.
Jonathan Cohn, senior editor of The New Republic. He has a blog there, and he wrote the book Sick. Jonathan, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, July 29th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. This morning, ExxonMobil said higher oil prices and higher demand helped profits more than double to $7.5 billion. Also this morning, the government said new claims for unemployment benefits fell last week, but only by 11,000. So let's put those numbers in perspective now with economist Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial joining us from Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
Slight drop in new unemployment claims, but still, Diane, if I told you a year ago 450,000 people a week would still be filing jobless claims, what would you have said?
Oh, not a chance. I would have expected 100,000 less than that. We should be seeing 350,000 at most claims a week, and we should be seeing more jobs generated. So these numbers are still extremely elevated from everything from long to people reapplying and having to re-up their unemployment insurance, and also the fact that, you know, we're just not generating many jobs out there.
Speaking of which, you just heard me say more big companies reported big profits this morning. Exxon, Avon, Disney, Goodyear. Diane, doesn't that eventually have to mean more jobs?
Well, it will mean some more jobs, but the real job generator is small businesses, remember, and they have been very reluctant to hire. They were hit harder by the recession and don't have the credit to lever back up and even grow, even if they have an opportunity out there, which has really slowed our ability to generate jobs going forward. We're also now facing the headwinds of the layoffs from the census and layoffs at the state and local sector, which are going to be quite substantial. Those pink slips came in the mail in July for many teachers.
Okay. I hope we're talking about an improved picture later this year. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Economist Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial. So I mentioned ExxonMobil's big profit. This morning, Europe's biggest oil company, Royal Dutch Shell, said its earnings almost doubled. Yes, Shell is Europe's oil king now. It used to be BP, but the Gulf oil spill has knocked BP off of that throne. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard compares BP and Shell.
Both companies specialize in deep water drilling. Both have a major presence in the Gulf of Mexico, but there the similarity ends. While BP reported a $17 billion loss this week, Shell has just unveiled a $4.5 billion profit. The company has benefited from the higher price of oil. Production is up and costs are down. And, of course, most crucially, Shell has avoided any major disasters. Nevertheless, the company will pay some of the price for BP's debacle. Nick McGregor analyzes the oil industry for stockbrokers Redmayne Bentley.
Deepwater drilling globally is going to become a slower and more expensive process. Getting regulatory approval will take longer, and once you've got it, it's going to be a more expensive business due to the much heightened safety requirements.
In today's profit report, however, Shell makes clear it won't be scaling back its deep water operations. It says offshore gas and oil are vital for future supply. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Today marks an important beginning in the giant legal battle over the BP oil disaster. A panel of federal judges in Boise, Idaho, will decide how to handle more than 250 lawsuits related to the incident, filed in 12 different states. We get more now from Marketplace's Chrissy Clark.
The judges will look at how to consolidate the cases, and just as important, where. Here's why geography matters. The lawsuits involve a complicated web of liability and billions of dollars. So plaintiffs and defendants want every edge they can get. That includes the sympathies and conveniences that might come with a friendly location. BP's lawyers want the court to be in Houston, a.k.a. Oil City. They say it makes sense because the company has headquarters there and it's an airline hub. But many of the people suing BP say New Orleans is a better site, closer to where the oil spill actually happened and the people it's affecting most. Georgine Vero, a professor at Loyola Law School, says the federal panel will weigh those factors, but will probably say,
I don't really care where you want to be. Here's where we're going to put you. And they have, over time, chosen neutral forums.
Wherever the cases wind up, the chosen city could get an added economic boost. It will host thousands of lawyers, witnesses, and members of the media for years to come. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
The energy bill under debate in Congress now is less ambitious than what many Democrats once hoped for. One idea Democrats abandoned was putting a tax on carbon production. Marketplace's economics editor Chris Farrell says tax or no tax, the price of carbon is headed up, especially the carbon contained in a barrel of oil. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Bill.
Chris, oil is under $80 a barrel, which, you know, it's a lot less than what it was a couple years ago, right?
Oh, but Bill, think about it. What have we been talking about for the past several months? A slowing economy, not just here in the U.S., but in China and in Europe. And yet oil has been up for the past 3 months, up to around the $77, $78 barrel level. And it was only back in 2003, it breached $30 a barrel. So what that tells me is that the price of oil is going to go a lot higher.
How much higher, you think?
Well, I think it's very easy to say $100 a barrel. Now, that's what the Saudis say is the equilibrium price if the whole global economy is growing. But remember, Bill, it went up to $147 a barrel in 2008.
Right.
So if the global economy is growing and production has peaked, the loss is supply and demand, you know what they tell you? A higher price. So $100 a barrel. We may look back on that and say, hey, that was low.
Well, as you said, we hit 140-something a couple years ago. How bad would $100 a barrel of oil be?
It would be bad because I think there is no doubt. Now, there are many factors that played into the Great Recession, the worst downturn since the 1930s. But it's very clear economists have looked at it, and one of those factors was the high price of oil. So our economy is very vulnerable to an increasing price of this precious commodity. And that's why we need to have alternative energy, or else it's the risk that it's going to be energy once again, oil once again, will help put this economy back in the soup.
What are the odds alternative energy is going to come along and save us from an oil shock?
Eventually, it will. My guess is the price of oil is going to go up. All of a sudden, we'll be scrambling with alternative energy. We'll dip down again into a recession or some sort of sluggish economic growth. But we'll finally climb out of it. I just wish that we would accelerate the process so we don't have to go through this boom and bust cycle again.
The uncharacteristically pessimistic economics editor of Marketplace, Chris Farrell. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Bill. And Bill?
Yeah?
I hope I'm wrong.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, July 29th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. China has enjoyed strong growth over the past few years, even with a lot of other countries in recession. But there's a negative side to all those factories running. Its air quality has suffered. A government report out this week shows more than 100 Chinese cities had the worst pollution levels in 5 years. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Beijing's Ministry of Environmental Protection blamed sandstorms for some of this year's poor air quality, but scientists, environmentalists, and most others weren't buying it. They placed the blame elsewhere, like on these things. China's roads are more clogged than ever, thanks to a surge in vehicle ownership and a growing consumer class. Greenpeace's Si Peng Cheng blames another culprit, the economy.
A huge part of the Chinese economic stimulus plan goes to infrastructure projects, and with that you are going to need more materials like cement, like steel, and those are highly polluting industries.
By 2020, China plans to use clean energy to generate more than a third of its power. That's an impressive statistic, but it's balanced by equally impressive energy demands from the country's rapid economic development. One indicator of that came earlier this month when the International Energy Agency reported that China has surpassed the U.S. to become the world's biggest energy consumer. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The recession has not been kind to real estate developers, but a little-known U.S. immigration program is helping get some big development projects off the ground in an unexpected way. From station WCPN, Dan Bobkoff tells us how it's working in Cleveland.
In their heyday, the flats along the Cuyahoga River were a hub of shipping and industry. Then manufacturing collapsed, and the flats were reborn as a party spot with bars and nightclubs. That scene died a decade ago, and it's been dormant ever since. In 2005, developer Scott Wolstein unveiled a $500 million plan to rebuild the flats. Then came the financial crisis.
Until the fall of 2008, financing was pretty easy to come by.
Wolstein couldn't get credit, and the Flats East Bank project was put on hold.
We certainly hope to be under construction by now.
But cranes may soon be moving into place after all. A group of foreign investors have put up $20 million to get the development off the ground. They come from countries as diverse as England, China, and Brazil.
Immigrants basically built the U.S. and will continue to do so.
Eddie Zai is an immigrant himself, and he's using that experience to encourage other foreigners to make investments in the U.S. He runs the Cleveland International Fund, and thanks to a once obscure U.S. immigration program, he can offer one huge incentive. It's called EB-5, and here's the deal. Invest in the U.S. economy, create at least 10 jobs, and you can be on a fast track to a green card, months instead of years. Zai says the wealthy foreigners are willing to put up with piddly returns for what they really want.
Primarily, it's education for the children and health care and access to health care for themselves.
The government's EB-5 visa has been around 20 years, but the number of investors getting green cards through the program has nearly tripled during the recession. Not everyone is thrilled, though. Ira Melman is with the Federation for American Immigration Reform.
You know, I think most Americans would find it inherently objectionable that we are selling admission to the United States.
But Zai says this immigration program is just like first class versus coach on an airplane.
The method of getting into the flight between going through TSA security is the same like everybody else. The way the flight operates is like everybody else. But they're just paying a higher amount to get in.
And Zai is not stopping. Next, he hopes to get more foreign investors to put money into Cleveland's film and healthcare industries in exchange for that first-class green card. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Bill Radke. This is Computer Hackers Week in Las Vegas. The city is hosting two hacker conventions, the Black Hat Conference that started yesterday. That one caters to corporations trying to protect their networks. And the more unruly DEF CON gathering happens this weekend. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler tells us some convention speakers have been pressured to keep quiet.
Hackers are folks who crack computer security systems for fun or profit, but they can also fix problems.
You need hackers to fight hackers like you need soldiers to fight soldiers.
That's Dan Kaminsky, chief scientist at Recursion Ventures, which focuses on computer security. He'll speak at the conference about new methods he's developed for blocking cyber attacks.
It is going to make for a much safer internet.
But some researchers have been encouraged not to speak. A Taiwanese expert had planned to address internet hacking supposedly done by the government of China. That's been canceled to avoid offending leaders in Beijing. Kaminsky says others may also feel pressure to keep security secrets private.
There may be pressure, but the reality is if we don't talk about how things actually fail, all of our advice is going to be worthless.
There's plenty of demand to see how security systems fail. Attendance at the Black Hat Conference is up 35% this year. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Remember a few months ago during a congressional hearing, Senator Carl Levin read aloud from a pretty colorful Goldman Sachs email.
Boy, that Timberwolf was one shitty deal. How much of that shitty deal did you sell to your clients?
I do remember that hearing. Well, the Wall Street Journal reports this morning Goldman Sachs has now ordered its employees to stop using profanity in emails.
Now, Bill, you emailed Goldman asking for a list of these newly banned phrases. What did they say?
I did, Steve, and you know, I can't figure it out. They didn't write back. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.